this video, we're going to discuss what are the optimal hormone levels in HRT. I'm Dr. Davidson.
I'm Dr. Mackey.
All right.
So we're back for another one. Now, this one is kind of a long question, but this is from Connie. So why don't you go ahead and read it, and we'll kind of dive right in. The papers, I will say that, you know, I can see why when people are like on the newscast and they're on their big, you know, their desk, they all have papers. They're always like fumbling around with the papers. The papers I find very comforting.
I like the papers.
I like the pen. You stole my pen. I want my pen. I always steal it.
All right. I'm going to read this question from Connie. She's a listener. In fact, she says she listens to all of our podcasts.
Thank you, Connie.
Shout out to Connie. Yeah,
thank you, Connie.
I do really appreciate her question. So here it is. Hi, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson. Really appreciate your podcasts and listen to all of them. My age is 56 and I went on BHRT about 3 years ago while not quite in menopause. My plan was to be proactive before the levels tanked, but it did create some issues with uterine buildup. That was addressed and all okay, but still trying to find a perfect balance. I'm in menopause now based on blood levels, and my goal is to be at optimal levels of hormone replacement in order to protect bones, heart, and brain. My current compounded cream of estradiol is 1 milligram and testosterone 0.5 milligrams. Progesterone compounded capsule is 225 milligrams, a bit higher due to my lining buildup in the past. And my last labs showed estradiol at 51.2, FSH at 70. Labs were run about halfway after applying my HRT, which I apply at night. Wanting the estradiol to be higher and the FSH to be lower, and realizing blood work with creams may be hard to pinpoint accurately, but do you think staying with these doses is optimal? Can the numbers get better with the same static dosing, or is this the best range I will get? Not really interested in having a period, what with the bleeding concern before, but does it make sense not to take progesterone every night, maybe every other? Would that help or hinder things? Thank you for any of your information. Sincerely, Connie.
Well, there's a lot going on there. She's got a lot of good questions. We really do appreciate Connie for listening to all the podcasts. So she's heard us talk about a lot of things. So she's 56 now. She started BHRT 3 years ago. I'm assuming, based on what she said, that the BHRT thickened her lining a little bit. So she must have had a transvaginal ultrasound. The lining was a little too thick. They probably did a DNC, would you imagine?
Oh, yeah. She said it was addressed and it's all okay. So she was in perimenopause, probably making a little estrogen, putting estrogen on top of estrogen. The uterine lining got thick. But she says it's all okay now and she's in menopause.
Yeah. So this is a question that comes up a lot, right? You're using numbers, lab numbers, to sort of dictate decisions. And I will say, doing this for as long as we have, that's a really challenging thing to do. So what do you think of Connie's question?
I think exactly what you're saying is the numbers are not supposed to be diagnostic. I've had a lot of patients that have come into me over the years, and they are so specific about what they want their lab numbers to look like, and they get really disappointed because they want, like a little bit with Connie, you know, her FSH is at 70. The higher the FSH, the, you know, the more you're technically into menopause. And I'm going to get into that in a little bit, but her estradiol at 51, she's thinking it needs to be higher because she's just looking at the numbers. But the numbers aren't diagnostic. They're just supposed to be a little bit of a, you know, one key in the picture or one piece in the puzzle to determine what direction we want to go to. I always go with their health goals. Like she says, she wants to protect her bone, heart, and health. I do feel like what she's already doing and what she's done in the past has definitely benefited that. I would go a little bit more into probably her symptom picture, her family history, her own personal history in terms of what direction to go into.
Yeah. So it's more of the subjective in, like you said, her family history, her personal history, as opposed to trying to chase a number on a lab test. Mm-hmm. Because that's where, when you're doing static dosing like she's doing 1 milligram of estradiol every day plus 225 milligrams of progesterone.
And a teeny tiny bit of testosterone.
And a very small amount of testosterone. The testosterone is going to help with the bones, mm-hmm. right? And if she's exercising and working out and doing her strength training, she's listened to our other podcast, she's heard us talk about that before, that is going to do a very good job of protecting the bones and maintaining muscle mass. Very important for women The number one factor for aging, you see it all over social media, all over YouTube. You've heard us talk about on the podcast as well. The number one factor for aging is what they call sarcopenia, which is basically muscle loss. So that's how you protect your bones and in some ways slow down the aging. You become sedentary, you don't move, as the adage is, if you don't move it, you lose it. That becomes even more important the older you get, because the more you don't move it, the quicker you lose it. So that part is very important. The hormones don't, the testosterone will play into that, but this is where dosing sort of actually matters. Now, with the static dosing, 1 milligram of estradiol, 225 milligrams of progesterone, fine with both of those. She's asking if the numbers are going to improve over time, if that's an optimal dose. What do you think of that?
Well, I would say, first off, so she's taking that progesterone, like she said, at 225 milligrams at night. It's an oral capsule. Progesterone helps thin that lining of the uterus and prevents estrogen from thickening it, because having a thickened uterus could cause some bleeding issues, can put you at risk for uterine cancer. So I'm glad that, you know, she's aware of that. Her practitioner is aware of that. That's great.
I'm sure she probably sleeps really well, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Progesterone makes you sleep so wonderfully, especially if it's sustained release. Yeah, progesterone is great. And
from a metabolic standpoint, you know, for metabolic health, bones, all that stuff, sleeping well is a big part of that. So maintaining insulin sensitivity.
For your mood, your sanity.
For your sanity, for your partners, your family sanity, sleeping is very important. So I'm hoping that at least she's getting a good night's rest with that kind of dose.
I'm sure she is. And what I would suggest is I would honestly, because I love bioidentical hormones. They're amazing, but they don't have as much longevity as some of the big box commercial hormones do. So I would honestly, with her estradiol, is I would probably split it up so she takes it morning and evening. Because right now she's just taking it in the evening. It doesn't have that long of an effect in your system. So let's say she takes it at 9 o'clock at night. She goes and gets a blood draw 12 hours later. Then actually a 51 is a really good number for somebody that's got a blood draw, you know, 12 hours later.
Because if you're applying it every 24 hours, once every day, your numbers are basically dropping to zero and you're starting over every single time.
So that's why I usually find that if you split it up, like you take it in the morning and then you take it in the evening, it keeps that level of hormones consistent throughout the entire 24-hour period. And people do feel good. You know, taking your estrogen in the morning is great for getting that clarity. It's really good for the mood. It's good for that brain fog, trying to remember the words you're trying to say, trying to remember your friend's name, the name of that book, the name of that road. It's really good for that mental, you know, that mental clarity. And then of course, taking it at night helps you for the night sweats. That's a lot of times I'll have women take a little bit more estrogen at night rather than during the day, because they are plagued with the night sweats, and getting night sweats, you're not going to sleep good. So that I would say for Connie to really be optimal is not necessarily staring at the numbers, because honestly, an FSH of 70 is just fine for a menopausal, postmenopausal female.
It's appropriate. Yeah. It's sort of what it should be.
Yeah, you do not want, so the FSH is a signal from the brain, from the pituitary, and it's monitoring overall ovarian status. So if you're, so somebody that's maybe 25 and they're cycling, they're having a period every 28 days, 26 days, their FSH is going to be around 2.5 to 4. So that's appropriate because they're cycling the hormones. For a postmenopausal female taking static dosing hormone replacement, you want that number to be in what's considered a menopausal range. Connie would not want to have an FSH at 10 or 8 or 2. No. That would mean something was seriously going on. Like maybe there's some other issues.
And more than likely her estradiol would be way too high.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, it would
so
be too high.
With static dosing, that was my point. With she wants her estrogen level higher and her FSH lower. But with static dosing, there's a trade-off. You have to be careful with that. You don't want her estradiol to be too high. And the higher the estradiol goes, the lower the FSH goes. That's where you sort of run into problems a little bit.
And I love that she's looking at that preventative, right? She's thinking about bones. Of course, when the estrogen drops, especially for us females, we're so prone to that, you know, the bone density deteriorating, going into osteopenia, you know, osteoporosis. So of course, having your DEXA scans every 2 years to check for your bone density would be important. And if you see some changes, then you know you might need to make some. And really, the hormones are great for bones, but the lifestyle, like you said, maintaining muscle really helps hold on to our bone density. Yeah.
Now, the hormones help with the muscle, but the muscles help with everything else. Muscles, you know, there has been absence of the importance of muscle in medicine. Not understanding, you know, everyone's trying to lose weight, you know, Ozempic, semaglutide, liraglutide, tirzepatide, it's all about losing weight, but what you're doing in that respect. Now, I don't have any problem with those things. There's some people that really do really well with those medications, and that's totally fine. However, it exacerbates the muscle loss in almost every case. And a woman that's in her 40s, 50s, and 60s, the last thing she needs to be doing is purposely losing muscle tissue, because if you lose that muscle tissue at that age, good luck trying to get that muscle back. I turned 50 this year, and you and I work out pretty much every day in the garage, and you'll be, maybe you wouldn't be shocked, but it is very challenging to actually build muscle when you're in your 50s and beyond. And if you're doing something that is, you know, either focused on caloric restriction weight loss, that is only going to exacerbate that. And, you know, like I've said, the number one factor for aging is sarcopenia. Hold on to your muscle, do whatever you can to try to build the muscle. That is going to bode very well for longevity in improving your health span over, you know, over the years when you really need it the most.
Absolutely. So like I was saying, you know, she's thinking about being this preventative, being proactive, and I love that, but there's, I'm hoping, which I know because Connie listens to our podcast, that I'm sure that she's aware of doing the lifestyle aspects, that really the hormones are like the frosting on the cake. It's not the main, you know, cake of the matter. It's just the accoutrements that you put on top as the hormones. So I do, you know, so I would say in terms of for Connie is really just, I would split up that estradiol, maybe even convert it into a bias, because I love estriol combined with estradiol. It just has a nice, you know, estriol can kind of buffer some of the negative effects of estradiol. Estriol is great for your skin and your hair. So I love that little combination, as I would switch it to that and have her do it twice a day. You know, split up the dose, do it twice a day, keep the progesterone the same as long as she's feeling good on that, not feeling too tired the next morning. And then, you know, the testosterone's great. Some women can tolerate a half a milligram, 0.5 milligrams of testosterone, and other women can tolerate 5 milligrams, some 10 milligrams. It depends on the person, you know, what they're, if they're having a negative symptoms to that. So I would say for Connie is splitting up that the estrogen into twice a day, but then also maybe looking a little bit more into what are her health goals. Like, if, you know, a lot of women have different health goals.
She's only at 1 milligram. She could easily raise that dose.
She could raise
that dose, not trying to chase the blood number. Mm-mm. Okay. Cause you want that number. Okay. So let's just say, or hear it directly from you. So let's say you raise your dose a little bit. It doesn't even matter what it is. Where would you want her, the upper limit of her estradiol to actually be?
If like, you're doing, yeah, static dosing, you honestly do not want it to go over 100.
Yeah, that, 75 yeah. to 100,
now,
somewhere
if you're doing
there.
Rhythmic dosing, and that's a whole other thing that we've talked about before where you're having
now,
a period.
She alludes to that part yeah, when she says, not really interested in having a period. Mm-hmm. See, that's the big difference, right? So she's listened to our podcast before because she knows the big difference between static dosing and rhythmic dosing is the amount of estrogen that you're using. The doses she's using, there is no such real thing as an optimal level, because we don't want her estradiol level to go too high, because there's a danger in that, which is what she experienced when she was 53. You don't want that number to be too high. Now, granted, at 225 milligrams of progesterone every night, probably not going to happen. So she could raise her estradiol a little bit more. She could definitely, if she's able to tolerate skin-wise, she could easily raise her testosterone a little bit more. For what you prescribe for women, what's an upper end testosterone dose that you use?
You know, testosterone is really interesting. I have some women that can tolerate well above the reference ranges and they are awesome. And I have some that can barely tolerate any, but I would say on average for a testosterone with some replacement, you're doing a static dose where it's every day, is really closer to about 30 to 45. For that reference range.
No, I'm talking about the actual dosage itself. Not the lab test.
I would say probably an average dose that a female takes that I have from in my experience is probably around, you know, 2 to 5 milligrams daily.
2 to 5 milligrams.
Because I know a lot of people, like, you know, they do the pellets and they make those levels go so high and then you have to wait for them. And some people like the pellets. I don't personally, because you can't tailor the dose.
Once it's in.
Once it's implanted, you got to wait for it to leave before, you know, you can, so you can't take it away. So that's why I do really like what Connie's doing here. And if she wanted to have the optimal hormone levels, is not chasing the number, like you said, not chasing the number on that lab rec, but doing, I would do it twice a day, probably even raise up the dose a little bit, add in an estriol to create a biased, and then keep that progesterone at night, maybe even push up that testosterone a touch too.
Yeah, 2 to 5 milligrams, that's a very common range. Honestly, it's probably closer to 2 than it is to 5. Yeah, some get to 5.
Maybe go to 1, maybe 1 for her, since she's already at 0.5, sure. Go up to 1.
And then it's always better to kind of be, so you and I are pretty conservative in the start of testosterone, mm-hmm. because the three things you're going to look for is blemishes or breakouts, hair growth on the chin, the areola, mm-hmm. and then of course hair loss. We never usually let it get to the hair loss point. If you're having hair issues, you want to be very careful with DHA or testosterone. You don't probably want to start those if you're already having some hair issues, because it could just exacerbate. Shedding and hair loss also has a big impact on stress. So if you're not sleeping very well and you're having stress on top of that, the stress needs to be dealt with, and the hair, usually it's about a 90-day lag time between the stress and the hair shedding. One thing I did notice, I don't know if you noticed this during COVID, everyone was sort of like left at home and they're just hanging out with their families, and everyone's, I have quite a few people, some people's stress didn't change at all, and then some people's stress changed dramatically. And guess what? Their hair stopped, their shedding reduced at the same time. And then most of them sort of actually realized, oh yeah, we're just hanging with my family, having a great time, and then my hair stopped falling out. nonetheless, stress and hair issues kind of go hand in hand. So the dosage, like she said, she's at a half, she could go to 1, she could go to 2, she could go to 3, go to 4, go to 5. The cosmetic issues, the breakouts, the hair growth, the hair loss, that's what you're looking for. What about on the lab test side? Where is there a number on the lab test for testosterone that you're trying to stay in between, or what do you think about that?
Yeah, the reference ranges on there are like, depending on Quest or LabCorp, 2 to 45 nanograms per deciliter.
Something to 60, I think another one goes up to 60.
Up to 55, another one, it's like 7. So they're huge reference ranges. I mean, somebody at 2 is not going to be a normal testosterone versus somebody at 55. Usually, like I was saying earlier, usually around 30 to 45, depending on if they're having in the symptoms. Because that's the key with when you're doing hormone replacement with a patient, you can't, like you've said this before, you can't cookie cutter, give them a dose and say, okay, I'll see you in 6 months. You have to have that continual sort of communication with the patient to say, I've been on this and I got some spotting, or I've been on this, I got my migraine, or I've been on this, I have more hot flashes, or I'm having, breakouts, or my libido's different. Because then you've got to alter it and find that specific kind of tailored dose for that patient.
Right.
So that's where that communication comes in. And we do get a lot of questions from listeners, and I think they're not having that communication with their practitioner, because they should be able to change that dose if they're having a reaction to it.
Yeah. And we see these doses come in 1 milligram, 0.5 milligram. There's a little bit of hesitancy about giving women too much.
You got to start somewhere.
But there's still hesitancy about prescribing more than a little. And in order to get optimal levels, you actually have to prescribe some of the hormone to get to optimal anything. So I think your reference range was a little bit conservative, because you and I both have quite a few patients that have elevated testosterone. So what do you do if they come back, they're on testosterone, doesn't even matter the milligram, they come back and their testosterone level is elevated, either in the high double digits or in the low triple digits?
Like you said, you're not chasing the number. They might have put their testosterone right before their blood draw.
I understand that.
We communicate with the patient. Are you having any breakouts? Are you feeling testy? Are you, having any hair loss? How are you feeling? Okay. If you feel great,
okay, I'm asking you a specific question. Okay, so they're not having any symptoms because they've been on it for a while. Their number is 160, 130. What do you do?
If they feel fine, I keep it right as is.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's all my point. That's my point.
If they feel good, if that's something that works for them, absolutely. And if it doesn't, I would have heard about it well before they came in for that appointment.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's my point, is that the number, especially for testosterone, as long as those cosmetic things are there, there's actually, some literature to support having a higher androgen number like that. In some ways, you and I have seen this many times, when a woman's in perimenopause, as her hormones are dropping, the androgens sort of prop up anyway sometimes, not always, but sometimes, as like a little compensatory mechanism. So there's no real harm in having a higher testosterone level. So her dose at 0.5 milligram could easily go up if she's looking to preserve bone and muscle and, some of that, functional aspect of her health.
And also with the progesterone, she mentioned that question of, does it make sense not to take the progesterone every night? it makes sense to take the progesterone every single night. Don't not take it.
Yeah, the progesterone is not offsetting the estrogen. Like it doesn't counteract the progesterone or the estrogen. Yeah. So
take it every night.
Especially if you had an history in the an issue in the past or history of a thickened lining. We don't know any details about that. But in static dosing like this, you have to take your progesterone all the time. We would never prescribe estrogen for a woman without any progesterone. She has to take the progesterone in conjunction, because if you don't, right, if you don't take the progesterone, then that lining will thicken and it can potentially cause a problem. Yeah,
the lining of the uterus, and then they get spotting. Like I said earlier, it could be a risk for cancer. We've talked a lot about, make sure if you're on any kind of estrogen and you have a uterus, take your progesterone.
Yeah, that's rule number one, no matter what. Safety first. If you're going to use hormones, it has to be done the right way. Believe me, there is a lot of controversy about that. The last episode, there was a woman that had a hysterectomy from another practitioner, and she was put on synthetic estrogen with no progesterone. But she had a hysterectomy, so the typical gynecological response is you don't need progesterone if there's no uterus. Even in those cases, we still prescribe the progesterone. Yeah,
progesterone is like the unsung hero of hormones. It's great for your hair. It's great for your mood. It's great for your sleep. It also helps buffer some of the negative effects of estrogen, because estrogen is an awesome hormone, but she can have, you know, too much of it can be a little bit of a train wreck. So you want to make sure there's not too much estrogen dominance going on, and you have that progesterone kind of help buffer that.
Okay, now let's flip the script a little bit. So she's talking about optimized hormones from a static dosing perspective. Hard to do. Don't chase the numbers, because at 1 milligram, you're not going to get the dose that high. And you don't want to raise the dose too high, because you don't want the estradiol level to go too high. Okay. Now, she obviously mentioned, because she's listened to a bunch of our podcasts, she's not interested in arrhythmic dosing, which is totally fine. Most women are not. Once they get to menopause, the last thing they want is to continue a period for another who knows how long. And that's the difference, static dosing versus rhythmic dosing. Rhythmic dosing, we are sort of chasing the numbers a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we are trying to push that estradiol level up there to, for a woman that's 56, kind of into an uncomfortable level if you're unfamiliar with what rhythmic dosing is. So how would you differentiate static dosing and estradiol level and FSH versus rhythmic dosing, estradiol level and FSH?
Well, maybe you should explain what the rhythmic dosing is and what it's doing.
Well, rhythmic dosing is basically, you're recreating the menstrual cycle. Yeah. You know, you are giving a woman a very particular hormone dosing schedule, 28-day cycle, or from period to period, right? Mm-hmm. So she is going to get a period. Usually women get a period right off the bat. The first month they start, the bleeding is what makes it safe to do. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the distinction, that when you're using static dosing, bleeding and thickened lining is not an option. Mm-hmm. In rhythmic dosing, the bleeding is actually the part that makes it safe, because that lining is building up because of the estrogen dose, and it's sloughing off every month because of the way that the hormones are positioned over that 28-day cycle, or most women average 24 to 28 days. Some are as early as 21. Some are, you know, usually most women don't go far beyond the 28. Yeah. Usually it's 28, pretty close. But there we are trying to drive up the estradiol level. So they are taking a fairly good amount of straight estradiol every month in order for that lining to grow, and then a progesterone amount that's high enough, and then it drops off to get the lining to slough off. So it's a very, very specific approach. That's where we sort of, at least in my mind, think more about optimization mm-hmm. than with the static dosing. Do you think of it the same way?
Yeah, because you really are creating a 28-day rhythmic cycle that a mensturrating female would have.
Let's say she was 30 or 35 and still having a regular period.
Yeah, that you're recreating that. So you would chase the numbers a bit, because you want that FSH. You would want that FSH lower, because you're putting in that estrogen. You want that peak of estradiol on day 12, because in a perfect 28-day cycle, you have your period day 1 to 4, 1 to 5, and then the estrogen starts to come up. It peaks out at day 12. And then once you technically ovulate, which you wouldn't be ovulating in postmenopausal rhythmic dosing, But in an ovulating, you know, younger female, they would have that estradiol peak at 12 that causes an ovulation right around day 12 to day 14, which then the progesterone comes up and then it peaks out at day 21 and then everything drops off. And then day 28, so you get a period.
I can tell right now we're sort of new to the YouTube, right? We're not on, haven't been on here for very long, but this would be a great thing to put in a, to have our editor put in an image of the female cycle, or even have a, behind us here, but have an image come in where you can see day one of the period, day 12 is an estradiol peak, day 14 is where a woman would ovulate. Obviously, you don't
start to produce the progesterone,
and then the progesterone starts to go up. It peaks on day 12. One of our lights just went off.
That's weird.
Sorry about that. It peaks on day 21, and then it starts to drop, and then that's what signals the woman's body to shed that lining off, and then she has another period.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so this would be a great spot. Enter graph, you know, but you can look it up on Google. You can just type in female cycle, and there's a picture of what the female cycle looks like. That's what we're trying to recreate with rhythmic dosing. We're trying to achieve very specific hormone numbers with the estradiol in that respect. That you cannot really do with static dosing.
Yeah, with the static dosing, we're not chasing the number. You know, for Connie, it would be protecting the uterus, which she already is, but maybe raising up her doses and then splitting up that estrogen into, you know, morning and evening, but just keeping that progesterone at night. You could even split up the testosterone to morning and evening because you can have a little extra testosterone for the day. That's great for the brain. That's great for drive. That's
especially
great
if
for
she's
ambition,
exercising.
For the exercise. And then at night you have it because that's when we have cellular turnover. That's when we build muscle because we're sleeping and, you know, our cells are turning over and we're having regrowth and reset and all that. So I would honestly, split up both her testosterone and estradiol or estrogen into morning and evening doses, but keep that progesterone. And even at, and she likes it. I'm sure she loves that 225 milligrams. I would keep it right there.
Yeah. There's no reason to stop and start that. It needs to be pretty much every day. Mm-hmm. That's going to protect the lining for sure. But it sounds like she's, you know, she's trying to be proactive. That means she's got the right mindset of taking those actions, both diet and lifestyle wise. And of course the hormones, as you said, the hormones are just sort of like the finishing touch to make sure there's a little bit of that hormonal stimulation to make sure that things don't decline too quickly.
Yeah.
We could spend a whole week on this one. We're probably going to come back to this type of a question because the optimal level thing comes up all the time. And it's not as simple as, well, your level should be this.
Yeah, everybody's level is different because we're all individuals.
Now one closing thought. So her number right now, just to put it in perspective, her estradiol level is at 51.2 on 1 milligram of estradiol. On rhythmic dosing, we're shooting for a range on day 12, as we just talked about, roughly between 300 and 350. Okay, that's a pretty high dose. Mm-hmm. That is what I would consider to be an optimal dose.
But that's only on day 12. Day 21 would be different.
Yeah, it'd be probably below 200. Yeah. It'd be probably below, you know, something
so you're
below
changing
225.
Changing the doses. Where in the static one, we want to keep Connie exactly the same.
But the trade-off with the rhythmic dosing is that period is going to resume. You do not want to have an estradiol level that high and have no period. If that's the case, that is where it's potentially dangerous, you know, from a uterine standpoint, and it's not possible. That's why on static dosing, her blood level just shouldn't be too high. Any final things to say about Connie, or is this one good for now?
I think this is good for now.
Okay, all right. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.